Okay, so we are live on Facebook, coming to you live, Talk Recovery Radio. Hey, Darren, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
And it's going good.
Welcome to our listeners on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, CFRO. You are listening to the week previous. Mm-hmm. So thanks for tuning in. And for those of your co-op members, please keep your membership alive and donate.
Yeah, more than ever. I mean, the show's always, for those of you that don't know, Co-op Radio is a nonprofit organization that lets people like us have radio shows on the weekly, and they totally operate on donations and membership fees and so forth. So you can go to cooperadio.org to make a donation. And Talk Recovery Radio is powered by New West Recovery, which is made up of Last Door Recovery Society and Westminster House. And this is our sixth season, hundreds and hundreds of shows and hundreds of guests. And we keep coming to you every Thursday, bringing you the latest in addiction recovery news. And if you like our show, that's awesome. You can go to our, if you're on our Facebook page right now, that means you like us already. But you can replay all of our shows on SoundCloud and YouTube and iTunes. And that's at talkrecoveryradio.com. So we got some interesting things coming up. It's Pride Week here in Vancouver. Our show's based in Vancouver. And, you know, we couldn't let recovery just stay silent. There's the Clean, Sober, and Proud, which I'm part of, for years has put together a substance-free zone at Pride. It puts on a float and so forth. So a lot of the community members have been asking, like, are we going to do anything this year? Are we going to do anything this year? And well, we can't do an event. Just too complicated to have an event. But you know, when 175 people died last month in Vancouver area, and 170 the month before, you know, it's all can't just do nothing. Yeah. So we came up with the Clean, Sober, and Proud Walk. So it's going to be on Sunday at noon. We leave the art gallery, and it's a physical distancing walk. So, you know, please respect social distancing. And we're going to walk down Howe Street, walk down Davie Street, and then we're going to stop at English Bay. And over to the left of English Bay, there's a little park, and we're going to set up the recovery mural. And from that recovery mural that's been painted by people in recovery, it's all about raising awareness about recovery during the overdose crisis. And also people can sign a petition, which is trying to get the federal government to officially proclaim September as Recovery Month. You can get the details at recoverymonthcanada.ca. And believe it or not, there's some MPs that we've called and contacted that just aren't interested, and or they've got some kind of excuse as to why they can't do it. And it's really bizarre. It's a nonpartisan issue. There's no policy changes. It's just an idea to spread the message of hope that recovery is possible and attainable. And it's a problem. Like, I mean, when you have MPs saying no, or just, you know, they have to think about it, it's kind of interesting that COVID has a recovery plan. Economic recovery plan, a health recovery plan. Addiction has no recovery plan in this country, and people are dying.
And sad that there's even a moment of consideration of how it would look politically if one of them were to support essentially the wellness of those with addictions and mental health. You know, what's this going to do to my reputation? If that is even a question.
Darren, it's unbelievable. We have a team of volunteers calling. Like, there's actual MPs out there that have just responded in the most bizarre way, just the most bizarre way that's not supportive. You know, there's about 300 MPs in this country. We've got about 20 so far that have voted yes on Motion M40. That's disgraceful.
And I think it magnifies this separation of harm reduction and you know, the term recovery as two separate things, that if you support one, you're anti, you know, the other. And that's the sickening part, is that even in our regular conversations with somebody that's say more pro harm reduction, and you and I, you know, bring up recovery, it's this automatic defense mechanism, and it just shouldn't be that way. There's a bridge that's missing, and we are just always trying to talk about that necessary bridge between the two.
So if you're listening or you're watching, like, this is serious stuff. You know, Motion M40, it's been brought to the House by MP Peter Julian. He's looking for unanimous consent from all parties. It's a nonpartisan issue to make September officially Recovery Month. And there's no policy changes. It's just an optic, just like Pride Month is, you know. Yeah, we had to get a proclamation for Pride Month for June, and there's many others, and it just starts this little process of the conversation about hope and recovery, and like I said, there's about 300 MPs, and only 20 have actually said yes. So like, there's an overdose crisis, you know, there's people dying right now every second, and some MPs are like, I don't know if a yes vote's good for my career. So call your MP, go to recoverymonthcanada.ca. There's an easy form. Just fill out the form. It automatically sends an email. If you know an MP, call them and ask them, you know, what their vote's going to be, and tell them that this matters. You're listening to Talk Recovery Radio 100.5 FM, coming to you every week on Thursdays. Thank you, Co-op Radio. Thank you, New West Recovery. And we bring you different doctors, scientists, personal stories, you name it. If you have a story that you want to tell us, email pr@lastdoor.org. We'll try to get you on the show. Darren, who are we talking recovery with today?
Yeah, we get to talk recovery with a few today. Guests we've had on the show before. They are popping up on the screen. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
So thank you. If the names aren't up there, we have Dr. Raju Hajela, we have Sue Newton, and we have Paige Abbott from Health Upwardly Mobile, which is a wonderful addiction mental health resource in Calgary, Alberta. I mean, we have always gotten into many different topics on the show, which I hope to do again today within the three of you, obviously. You are all co-authored this third book together, Love the Drug, from the Trap of Addiction to the Freedom of Recovery. So this touches on underlying issues in people's lives, relationships, those in difficult relationships with people using, or really unhealthy behaviors. Why did this seem like the next topic or the next step in your writing? And that goes to whoever.
I can start the answer, but I would defer to Paige, because I've been doing this for decades, as you know, and even after people stop using substances, addiction is such a broad disease that it affects every aspect of a person's life, and especially the relationship with themselves and relationship with other people. So it's something that our patients had asked for.
Okay.
And it seemed like a natural follow-on. And in our books, we followed the pattern of me being the first author of the first one, Sue being the first author of the second one. So it was natural to have Paige as the third author of the third one, the first author of the third one. So with that introduction, I would invite Paige to share more about the book.
Yeah, I would certainly echo what Dr. Hajela said, that it's something that comes up so often with our clients and our patients that it just seemed like the next natural step to explore. And certainly clinically, it's something that all of us work with most of our days every day. So it just seemed really important to have a resource that we could direct clients towards, and not just our clients, but also to the more broader population, because it's something that so many people struggle with. Certainly everyone who has addiction and is in recovery would benefit from looking at their relationships. And this is an encouragement to do that and a tool that people will hopefully find helpful to be able to do that in more depth for themselves. Because, you know, it's something that gets talked about in the 12-step programs and other programs of recovery, but it's still something that I've noticed people have so much shame and so much confusion around. And so more and more discussion to promote, hopefully, more and more clarity is certainly needed.
Yeah, it's part of the complexity of, you know, addiction being a brain disease and, you know, all of the issues that perhaps came about, you know, in childhood before any addictions and things like that. So when you meet someone with substance use, possibly mental health, at that point, and they get well and they're through it, there's all this unresolved stuff. You know, some will say trauma, some will say childhood neglect and abuse. And how important is that? And how easy do people sort of look beyond really dealing with that when you with your clients? Is it something that once the drugs are taken care of, they're conscious about avoiding it? Or is it just this thing that they hope takes care of itself once the drugs are taken care of?
It can be so both, like, from my experience. You guys can go ahead.
We usually see people when they first come to HUM, and it's pretty clear right from the get-go when they're still in active addiction that relationships are a huge trigger for their substance use or addictive behaviors. And so I do find that if people are willing and ready, they will talk about the relationships. And a big focus of this book too is relationship with self. And I love this book, and that I think even if you don't have addiction, if you live with somebody that has it, or, I mean, it's helpful for everyone who is in a relationship, because I think there always is a little bit of dysfunction in relationships, especially if there's some attachment. So I think it's valuable even beyond addiction.
I mean, that's going to be the majority of the population, you know. There's so many different, you know, relationship dynamics that could exist. Both people using, one person using, a family member and a son. I mean, it's all across the board. Does this book sort of branch into all of those areas?
Absolutely. All areas. And this is where, to just pick up from where Sue left off, this book applies to 100% of the population.
Right.
And especially healthcare providers, because as healthcare providers, we are helping other people. And fundamentally, people are familiar with the word codependency, where we can get enmeshed with other people's issues rather than dealing with our own. And as Sue was pointing out, and it's a very, very important point related to addiction, that, and certainly borne out by research and also in my clinical practice, that relapse, even to substance use, often is triggered by unresolved issues, as you said, from past. And most of those past unresolved issues are related to relationships with oneself and with other people. In this book, we've tried to highlight the difference between codependency and addiction involving relationships, because as in our first book, we emphasized addiction is addiction, where the disease is much bigger than the use of substances. And in our practice, we get people for substance-related problems, but we also get people who don't have substance-related problems, but they have addiction involving relationships or food or sex. And as Sue was pointing out, that no matter which door the person comes into for help, ultimately we have to address the relationship issues, and we have to clarify how addiction has been impacting it. And in that sense, from our perspective, we explain in the book how addiction involving relationships is even a more significant problem than the banner of codependency.
Right. Because we can often look at the most unhealthy person mm-hmm. in the relationship and point at the problem.
Yes.
Meanwhile, I don't really need any help. Look at how they're behaving.
Yeah.
Isn't it the best when somebody will pick up a book such as this for someone else?
Yes.
And like Sue mentioned, it hopefully they're open enough to sort of grasp and relate and identify, you know, what their part in it is and you know, possibly move on from that point. Does that just happen, or as authors, was it a point to sort of lead into that, you know, awareness when you're hoping that someone picks up a book for helping someone else?
I think our hope was that if someone's picking it up for somebody else, that they might start to browse through it a little bit themselves and start to see, oh, this isn't just about how does someone with addiction help themselves. It's also, excuse me, kind of a template and a roadmap for them about what can maybe I do differently. So hopefully it's something that it'll start to turn the lens internally rather than just focusing it externally on their loved one, because that just perpetuates the problem, right? That's yeah. something that's talked about quite a bit throughout the book, is rescuing, caretaking, trying to fix somebody else. Those are in the first half of the book, which are the symptoms of addiction. You don't see those talked about in the latter half of the book, which are the principles and the foundations of recovery. So hopefully, I mean, depending on how entrenched somebody is in that caretaking, rescuing behavior, they may not even flip open the book and they just want to shove it to their loved one and get them to look at themselves. But there is the hope that they will start to look a little bit internally at what they can do differently, because that's the real encouragement and that's the real theme of the book, is look at where you are at and what you are willing and able to do differently. This isn't about the people around you.
Yeah, I remember giving somebody a book on codependency because I felt that they were codependent on someone, and she threw the book at me. I was just like, well, you know, so, you know, there's obviously that response in real time, because usually people are in some type of a crisis, whether they know it or not, and so forth. So, I mean, that's the magic missing piece, is how, so a loved one's watching right now and they have somebody that's struggling still. Does the book touch on how do you inspire someone to even like acknowledge care? How does somebody get somebody to acknowledge that they need some help and may need to read this book and several other books? Any tips out there?
Yes, I can start, and then I'll invite Sue to comment on this. But just as a concept and the way the book is organized, we really focused in this book on sharing stories and sharing some important topics. So just as Paige said a few minutes ago, that the first half of the book is topics related to addiction. So we start out with things like intoxication, enmeshment, and various issues that are connected with how the disease manifests in relationships. And then the second half is about recovery. So there are stories about people in recovery and how people make that transition. So right in the opening story, Ashti, and you know, we wrote the book, but sometimes when you revisit it, you can feel the power. And I can say just recently, I reread the first story where this, a story that we've shared, which is a composite of a few of our patients. And the bottom line to that is, my name is Jolene and people are my drugs. So we try and engage people with very direct comments like that. And certainly it's a big part of our work, and Sue does a lot of work related to that. And she actually co-facilitates a group of women, and I think it'll be worthwhile for our listeners to hear about the experience in that group, because in that sense, women often who are in the care provision role can also be more vulnerable to addiction involving relationships.
Yeah, I think certainly what we've talked about is, I think it's a tendency for family members to, you know, push the book on somebody else and try and force people into treatment, when our emphasis is really look at yourself. We all play a role and we can make the situation better or worse. And so it's really turning things inward and looking at, like, what do I need to do to stay well and stay on my side of the street, as opposed to really focusing on fixing my children or my spouse, which I think is a big vulnerability. And certainly in our women's group, I think that probably the biggest topic is about relationships and how to help the children and their husbands. And often people get lost and they don't have their own self and or even identity. So really getting these women to look at what they can do to be the healthiest version of themselves and be in recovery for themselves. And typically when that happens, things do fall into place better and they're able to maintain strong boundaries and be healthy. So it's, again, it's really trying to get the emphasis back on looking at their own relationship.
Because it's contagious. I mean, when you add recovery to family dynamics, you know, someone's getting well, and the cycle of, you know, manipulation starts to tear down and starts to break down. And you know, I don't, you know, a lot of times when I talk to people that may have a loved one that's still out there, it's like, you know, once you start going to Narnon or Al-Anon or whatever family support group you go to, something happens. It's like, the person that's still using is like, shit, the gig's up. Like, they know that I know that, like, you know, they know that I don't need $20 for food. You know what I mean? And like, they like the truth of what's really going on. And sometimes it's a dark truth, but if we don't start talking about what's really going on, like, we'll never do the recovery. You know, something happens, which I think a lot of this conversation's about is, you know, I work for Last Door, so I'm around a lot of people that are in their first 30 days or 60 days of ever, you know, being in a recovery world and so forth. And they say, you know what, like, I was addicted before I even did drugs. Like, I remember being young and just like these behaviors that I had. And so I wanted to talk to you three about, you know, it's in the outline of the book, you know, that it's a chronic brain disease. Okay. And, you know, there's still a big war in social media that, you know, there's the people that say it's a choice. There's the people that say it's a choice and a brain disease. And then there's people that say it's like, there's no choice. What does that even mean? What does it mean by being a chronic brain disease for someone that doesn't have a PhD?
Yeah, I think it's an important concept to bring forth. So thank you for asking that question. And there is confusion. And on the matter of choice, I would say it's based on an assumption that most of the world operates on, that somehow all of us have a healthy functioning brain and we can make healthy choices. Unfortunately, science has shown us that's actually not true. And even with mental illness, there's that dichotomy that either somebody has mental illness or they are well. When in reality, there's a spectrum. And this is where when someone says to me, well, 10% of the population or 20% of the population has mental health problems. And my answer is that 100% of the population has mental health problems. We have to look at the severity of the problem. Right. And similarly, addiction being largely a genetic disease, as you shared, that a lot of the time people realize once you start talking to them that they had problems even before they started to use substances, which is why there's another concept that hasn't been mentioned yet that people gravitate towards, that they say addiction is self-medication. But it's not self-medication, it's actually a disease of escape. In that sense, you can even say it's a disease of choice, meaning the choice-making part of the brain is not working right. And I hope that makes sense to the listeners, because sometimes family members are trying to shake the other person who's making these bad choices or wrong choices to make better choices. Even in treatment, sometimes if the focus is too much on behaviors, then people try really hard to change behaviors. But if you don't recognize that it's a brain problem, then you don't get anywhere. And what we find, our approach, which is based on the absolute latest scientific advancements that have led to the definition of the disease, which is that it's a primary disease, it's a chronic disease, and it's a disease of brain circuitry. And the science has advanced enough that we know exactly that the reward circuitry is involved, motivation circuitry is involved, memory circuitry is involved. And that's where when you talk to people who have addiction, they will tell you that I had this problem even before I started using substances, and I still have this problem after I stopped using substances. And at that level, as we've been trying to emphasize, that this disease in the brain interferes with people having a healthy concept of themselves and having that ability to make healthy choices. So I hope that makes sense to the listeners, that it is important to explore that biological aspect of the disease and look at the psychosocial spiritual aspects for sure, but not forget the biology.
It's an intense thing to try to describe, define, explain, again, because of the complexity of drugs and upbringing. What do we see as the generic sort of across the board behaviors when it comes to be codependents or users that are struggling after the identification phase? Have you been able to sort of identify a theme, whether it's commitment or like accepting love or giving love, or is it just sort of
that comes to my mind is connection. And that's kind of the theme of the book that we wrote, is it is all about connection. And we say right at the outset of the book that we're not just talking about connection with other people, that's part of it. But as Sue said, we're also talking about connection with the self. And we're also talking about connection with spirituality, whatever that looks like for the individual. So if that's nature, if that's humanity, if that's energy, if that's religion, whatever it happens to be. But it's the connection piece that I've observed really gets lost in people when addiction is active. And that's where it has consequences in all parts of life. So that's the word that comes to my mind. I don't know what Sue and Dr. Hajela would bring forward, but that's mine.
Is this where we sort of get lost in the science? Like, we can sort of see the brain activity and what's missing or what's added to it, but we can't X-ray our souls and our spirits in that sense to know where they connect, right? So what is the process of either building somebody up to allow them, somebody else to connect to them, or for them to connect to themselves? What does that process look like?
Well, the comment that I would make before, if I may, and then go to Sue, is that we try and emphasize that on the basis of the circuits, that you can simply look at that as a shame generator. Mm. Like, if we look at the patients who have addiction, and people who have addiction, they have more shame than the average person. So it takes a lot of honesty and open-mindedness and willingness, something the 12-step program recognized decades ago, to cut through that shame and recognize that when that inner voice takes over and or somebody says something from the outside, and that shame is triggered, that it is really not about the person, it's about the disease.
Okay.
And at that level, engagement starts to happen. And I would welcome Sue's comments as well, because at HUM, Sue is the first point of contact. And she sees people at that level when they're ambivalent, they are so much in shame that they don't really want to talk honestly. But we're able to engage them wherever they're at. So Sue can talk about that process a little bit more.
Yeah, and I find as Dr. Dan, this is a disease of escape. So many people come in and they've escaped any uncomfortable feelings. And so they're very disconnected from themselves. And it goes back to that connection piece that Paige was talking about. You know, as they get healthier and sober and they start to connect to themselves and feelings, that's when we really see the transformation in people, because then they're able to be more authentic, be connected to their shame, other feelings, and then they can be more proactive. They can be more assertive, can have boundaries. But until then, I find that people don't even know what they want. And that's when we see dysfunctional patterns and relationships, you know, difficulty with boundaries. So it's really going back to understanding themselves and learning that there's no such thing as a bad feeling. It can feel bad, but it's important to connect with those feelings, and they are our truth, and they tell us what we need.
Yeah, I've always had this theory since becoming the most self-aware I could have been at the time, was that, like, through my life, there were moments of celebrations and, you know, this, like, yeah, I've never done that by myself. Like, it's always because there's people around, I'm on a team, you know, birthdays are celebrated, it's a party. However, in comparison, anything I was gravely, deeply embarrassed or remorseful or regretful about, I dealt with purposely solo, all by myself. I wasn't bringing in the neighbors and bringing in my friends and bringing in my family. So that's, I believe, for myself, where my unhealthiness came from. And to, you know, sort of to do the opposite in recovery was to allow literally groups of people in the hardest, most uncomfortable, deeply regretful, guilty, shameful moments. And that's where I understood the importance of connectivity and community. You just sort of, I took it for granted that there would always be people there during a celebration. And so I never looked past that. Am I on the right track? Does that make sense?
And do you find now that your relationships are deeper because of that? Because you're basically being more vulnerable and authentic.
And it allowed me to understand what the human nature, that spirit needs, more than people at a party, more than people to celebrate with, people to lose myself completely with. And that's...
Well, there's the other part too. It's like when you surround yourself around people that may have similar stories than you, you realize your life ain't that bad, you know, compared to some other people. It's like, what happened to you? It's like, holy smokes, you know, and there's that whole, you know, like, I remember when I showed up, but, you know, I thought I had the best novel in the world. Like, let's do a mini series on my horrible life. And then, you know, 30 days later, you know, when I came to, I'm like, you know, I've actually had it pretty good. And, you know, not to just devalue anyone's pain, but, you know, there's some truth in that for me. And I see it happening every day. People show up, you know, with this huge story. And 30 days later, it's like they don't even remember it anymore, and all that kind of stuff. So there's lots of power in that. And, you know, the idea, you know, and I like what Dr. Hajela said earlier, somewhere along the lines of, like, it's a medical issue, but it, you know, we can't just do one clinical intervention. Like, we can't just give somebody a house. We can't just give somebody medication. We can't just tell somebody to go to meetings every day. We kind of have to do a little bit of it all. And hopefully that person, so if you're out there and you're struggling, or you have someone that, you know, is struggling out there, like, the idea is, like, try everything, you know, just try everything. Because you, I know we've done shows with anti-12-steppers that are part of another, you know, mutual support group, they hated the idea of going to AA or NA. And like you hear them talk and mm-hmm. it's like they found inner peace. Mm-hmm. And like you can't devalue that, but you know, their way's no better than this way and my way's no better than that way. Mm-hmm. So how do, you know, you see patients every day. And I wanted to talk about the continuum of care and you know, you're three very involved people in Alberta. Are patients getting lost in the conversations about addiction healthcare? Like if you read Facebook, like you're being told, you know, what evidence-based is, you know, regardless if you're a scientist and, you know, consumption sites, no consumption sites, safe supply. Dr. Hajeli, you've been around for decades.
Yes.
I'm like really worried. I've never seen it's so bad when it comes to silos of care and groups of advocacy and advocates. Alberta is, you know, going through a lot right now. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about from the patient's perspective first. How's this affecting patients?
Well, patients are actually being adversely affected in a huge way. And in some ways, you have illustrated the fundamental issue. And this is a message to the listeners and to the public that unfortunately everybody has their theory of what causes addiction, and then they just want to fix that. So there are people who believe housing and homelessness causes addiction. So they just want to fix that and think that addiction will be fixed. There are people who think that people have mental health problems or psychiatric disorders, and you fix that and then addiction problems are solved. Or with opioids these days, if you just put people on Suboxone or methadone, then problems are solved. And it is that simplistic thinking that creates the confusion. So the continuum of care basically means recognizing that this is a primary disease, meaning nothing has really caused it. It's largely genetic with a whole lot of environmental factors that have psychosocial spiritual roots. And that's where what we do is we try and engage the person wherever they're at. And in that sense, even this polarization of whether someone needs abstinence-based approach or they need harm reduction, my question is, why are you even arguing about that? Everybody needs everything. Because when someone gets sick and tired of something that they're doing and it's harming them, then they try and change it. And as we were talking about earlier, when they try and change it, they realize it's not so simple. That there is that compulsiveness in the behavior, there is that impaired control over their behavior, there's craving. And what we do is really address the underlying issues that are connected with the shame generator, that are part of the dysfunctional emotional response. We help people expand their awareness so they can deal with the diminished recognition of problems in their relationships. So it's all a process, because even after somebody is establish abstinence with substances, as we were talking about, they still have to have harm reduction techniques that need to be applied in relation to food, in relation to sexual issues, and related to many of the people with their financial issues. So it is all very complicated. And it is the one size fits all approach that is a problem. Because I have difficulty with people who totally promote harm reduction as a solution. And I often say that that is actually a very pessimistic approach. And I've talked to so many people who are sort of committed diehard harm reductionists. They basically take the view that addiction is untreatable, that abstinence is not possible. So just focus on harm reduction. I partially agree with them, meaning absolute abstinence is not possible because food and relationships we have to continue to engage in order to live. So there are always those bottom lines and top line behaviors that people have to establish and then they live with. And that's why even at a definitional level, as you may know, through the American Society of Addiction Medicine and the Canadian Society of Addiction Medicine, we've actually defined harm reduction. And harm reduction means harm reduction is a means to an end, meaning it's a process of moving towards healthier behavior. We've even defined abstinence. With substances, abstinence is easy, that you're using or not using, But with behaviors, it's much more difficult. So we've actually defined abstinence as an intentional and persistent pursuit of restraint.
Oh no, I'm not abstinent anymore.
Yeah. So in that sense, what we do is in individual psychotherapy and group psychotherapy and educational sessions, so whatever it takes. And my pitch is the continuum of services need to be available for people so they can enter wherever they feel comfortable. And then they're given the full meal deal rather than being told that, no, you failed at this door, so go try another door. And then they fail at another door. Because what I say to people with addiction and recovery, there is no failure. Failure is not an option. And that's where long-term studies have shown that the key ingredient to success is long-term engagement.
Yeah. And you know, here we are, it's if you're below the poverty line and you're on welfare, if you're addicted to opiates, you'll be giving an SRO and a housing project, safe supply and access to consumption sites. But if you're a physician or a nurse or somebody with high financial capital, you like heroin just as much as that homeless person does, but you're going to a private treatment center with a, and I mean, no other healthcare system in Canada, maybe some other countries, but in Canada, if you break your leg, it doesn't matter if you're poor or rich, you're going to get the same therapy. But if you're, you know, having addiction, it's a totally different issue. And the general public just doesn't get that. I don't know why. They just don't get it. Like, you know, why is this person, you know, the goal is better health outcomes, and this person is, it just doesn't make any sense. So Paige, you're the, if I got this right, the main author of the book, and Sue and Dr. Hajela supporting your writing of this book. So people are going to read this book of, you know, people that are, have addiction issues or loved ones that are in a relationship with somebody that's having addiction issues. They can go to Helm's website to get the book and so forth. Do you have any, you have three books under all of your belts already? Okay. Are there any plans on another book? You know, that's maybe coming out and any ideas on what that might look like? What else needs to be talked about and put on paper?
Well, I have to laugh that as soon as we put out this book, someone would then wrote back and said, and when is the workbook coming out? So, so I think people are really craving practical tools in addition to the information, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing's been decided at this point, so I can't comment on that. But I think that's definitely something that's needed out there, is just to keep not just the conversation going, but to give people action steps. Because there's awareness that's important for the process of change. But action is also what's necessary and absolutely integral for change to happen. So people can sit and learn and take in information as much as they want. But without steps towards change and doing different, unfortunately, probably not a lot is going to change. And I think that ties into the conversation that's been happening for the last few minutes, is honestly wherever that action can start and can happen, I would say go for it. So for some people, that action will be to try and pursue abstinence from a substance. For others, it'll be to try and find a home. For others, it'll be maybe they go to a group meeting or group therapy, or they come see a counselor. For others, they pick up a book to learn more. Whatever it is, whatever that looks like for you, I just hope that people will take that action step. And just to clarify, we all were writers of the book. So part of the first author role really is just stick handling more of the editing and kind of the refinement process. But that's always the fun part of having three different people writing, is initially it can start off with three kind of very different voices, but then through the editing and refining to make it sound like it's coming from one coherent voice and perspective. I would say that was less of an issue than probably the first book that we did, but it's always interesting how there is still that personal voice that comes through in all of our writings. But yeah, we all took turns doing different chapters, and that's where it makes those stories interesting as well, because we can then pull in, like Dr. Hijala said, composites of clients that we've worked with over time to kind of convey that more personal message.
Yeah, for any successful addiction, mental health resource, counseling, therapy, it requires different people with different expertise and different talents and skills and experience in different areas. And I often found that when I'm reading a book just by one doctor, one author, it's their own, so I appreciate the collaboration, in such the same as somebody coming in into Health Upwardly Mobile. I just noticed as we were talking, and I think maybe all three of you mentioned it during our conversation about meeting somebody where they're at and how, and just sort of like just going from there, not working out this, 2-year plan, but just from right there, how do we get this person back? How do we get them, in this, how can we as a resource help this person right now? And in effect, that is harm reduction in its totality and in complete importance, and to reduce the harm as best we can and without sort of a force of an agenda or a personal opinion of what this person needs in their life. And like you said, Dr. Hijala, it could be that this person cannot obtain abstinence long term. At what point, and this is like professionally, personally speaking, at what point through an assessment does one sort of determine that? And I'm sure it's again a collaborative, opinion. Does somebody show that right away? Do they show that after a certain amount of time? Is there a sort of a spectrum to watch this person?
There's no formula, is what I would say initially. And that's what I was getting at before, that so many people are looking for that one formula.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you're picking up on them and emphasizing that we have to meet people where they're at. So unlike many other programs where people go and they are told, this is our program and this is how we'll help you go through it. Whereas we say, we just initially are doing an assessment where we show you all the different areas you can address. Then we actually invite them to say, what is it that you can start on? And in that sense, some people start on one thing, other people start on something else, and we tailor the program to the person. So no two people coming to HUM have the same program, even if they're going through the intensive outpatient program, which the people do as a group. But even there, the treatment is very personalized. So that is so, so important. And that's where I can say to you, some people who don't ever want abstinence initially end up in abstinence. People who've been abstinent for a while, I've had patients who are 3 years, 4 years opioid free. Right now, I have two patients in that category who've had to go on Suboxone, which is not a failure. And they are now getting their life in order, and they can now see what were the triggers that took them back to relapse. And there's a plan. One of them likely will stay on Suboxone a little bit longer than the other. The other one is already working on his way down. So it really varies from person to person. And if we look at the disease as a chronic disease, just like any other, it waxes and wanes. So if the disease becomes a little bit more serious and it requires more serious intervention, that's not a bad thing. It's just the way the disease is. And we have to look at it in that context.
Yeah, it's more like the mandatory stuff. Like we're like in the States, in Washington State, it's actually illegal to taper somebody off of Suboxone. And obviously that's a big pharma lobbyist bill. So now you've got talk about stigmatizing and talk about just painting everyone with the same brush. I mean, how that is just going to cause more harm than good. And some people, you know, if they have low recovery capital, they should probably stay on Suboxone if they're at high risk for relapse. Some people should be given the opportunity to taper if they wish, but you know, here in British Columbia, we have Dr. Sutherland, Dr. Patricia Daly, who are really respectable, high-end. I mean, they're also some of the top-paying physicians in the province, saying things like, if you're an opiate addict, you need to be on OAT for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and that's not
so. You know, that's why we're doing this recovery walk on Sunday. That's why we do this Clean, Sober, and Proud. That's why we do Recovery Day. It's you know, we've been so anonymous for so long that Canadians really thought people in recovery don't exist. Mm-hmm. And you see the people using on the streets. So that's what you see. And you know, we're hoping Alberta picks up on more Recovery Day events and louder and bigger Recovery Day events as well. So, you know, across the country, we could, you know, show that people can recover out loud and exactly. That it's possible and so forth. Because, I mean, you're a physician. I mean, to yeah. say that you need to do this for the rest of your life is, yeah. I mean, what is that? Did you learn that in school? Like, where did that come from? You know, like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, there is a recovery journey and a recovery process. So appreciate your time on the show. If you're tuning in, you're on Talk Recovery Radio 100.5 FM, powered by New West Recovery. Every Thursday, we've got the HUM team, you know, so if you're in the Alberta area and you're in Calgary and you have a loved one that may be suffering with addiction, please give HUM a call, Health Upwardly Mobile. And apparently you'll be talking to Sue first, you know, and you've been on our show in years past. Remember, I think the first show, Dr. Hajela, you were on was about marijuana.
Yes.
Remember that show? That was years ago. And who would have known this is where we're at today? Now it's safe supply. You know, you never would have thought that, you know, when we started this show years ago and so forth. Any closing notes from anyone before we sign out?
On that reminder, I would say that is the closing note, that our society is constantly changing. And awareness is so important, and awareness is changing as well. So even the idea of marijuana and safe supply, this is all part of the continuum. And we have to know the harms and not pretend that one thing is not harmful anymore. Like the harm related to marijuana hasn't changed just because legalization has come in. So we have to keep the dialogue going. And you asked for some teaser about our future book. And there is one in the works, and we are working on a matrix approach. So okay. Just like people may be aware of the Johari window that has four windows, we have a 9-window matrix. And the first box of that matrix is awareness. And the last box of that matrix is contentment, which is what all of us want. So that's a bit of a teaser then. We will let you know in time as to what the other boxes are, the other 7 boxes.
And well, hopefully, you know, with minds like yourselves at Health Upwardly Mobile, we'll get it through to the top tier and eventually, you know, it's funny you referenced the matrix. It won't just be, you know, take the red pill or the blue pill. Right,
exactly.
Yeah, because I'll just take both. Yeah, I just want to go on the idea of contentment. I mean, so many people that are sadly, you know, still using substances. The idea, like waking up in the morning with no regrets.
Yeah.
You know, from what may have happened, it's so empowering. And if you would have told me years ago that that's going to happen, I wouldn't have understood, because I woke up every day for 20 years with a lot of regrets. And then, you know, that goes away. And then that's, you know, the whole idea of recovery. It's like, you don't know what recovery is until you actually start it. And it's all about contentment. I'm happy with my job, my relationships, myself, and that is, you know, the idea of recovery. So I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Excellent.
And thanks for inviting us on the show again. It's always fun to do this with you both.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm glad that we were able to get all three of you on the show.
Well, as long as you keep writing books together, we're having all three of you on.
Yeah,
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, we're talking Dr. Ajayla Sue Newton, Paige Abbott from Health Upwardly Mobile. Don't forget, if you didn't hear us in the beginning, this Sunday we're doing a Clean, Sober, Proud walk. Starts at the Art Gallery at noon, down Howe Street, down Davie Street to English Bay. And then at English Bay, we're going to have set up the recovery mural that was painted by a bunch of people in recovery, and also the memorial tree. Sadly, thousands of names are on this tree. Is going to be set up at English Bay. And it's simply an opportunity to raise awareness. It's also being considered a still float because we can't actually have a float in a parade. So it's going to be on the seawall, so people walking by can see our still float, take a picture, and hopefully sign our Recovery Month Canada petition. COVID protocols in place. So disposable pens, all that kind of stuff. We've got it all covered. So you can go to recoverymonthcanada.ca if you can't be in person to sign the petition and call your MP. Only 20 out of 300 MPs have said yes. That's disgusting. So we need to get MPs in Canada to have a unanimous consent vote for Motion M40. And Sue, Paige, and Dr. Ajayla, if you could please let all your network know the same thing. Thank you for writing the book. We'll get you on the show again when we have our new book going. And thanks for watching and listening, everybody. Bye, Darren. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care.